one of the, not only a Rumi expert, but also one of the leading reformist thinkers in the Muslim world today, who's been situated in the tradition, as I mentioned in the email flyer, of the late Muhammad Iqbal, the poet philosopher of the Indian subcontinent. Without further ado, Dr. Abdul Karim Surush.
A brief history of his life is needed as in order.
he said, formal physical. He said that he had been met in his work, in his verses, in his poems. Therefore, in order to understand him and to know him well, we have to understand his words and his poetry in the first place. Now, the word Rumi, of course, means Roman. And he was not a Roman, of course. He was a Persian, Egyptian. And more specifically, he was an Afghan. He came from Afghanistan, where last year, I would say, was liberated, if you like. And so he was from a city in Astan that doesn't exist nowadays. The city was called Balkh. And because of that, we Persians, we Iranians, and in the whole Arab world actually, we do not call him Rumi. It is not a word which is often used. And if you use it, it's okay. And people, especially the educated one, will understand you, not talk about it. But it is not a word to be used quite frequently in educated circles in Iran and the Arab world. We call him Balkhi. And this Balkhi means somebody who comes from Balkh, from the city, non-existent city of Afghanistan. Of course, there is a city in place of Balkh, which is nowadays called Mazar-e-Sharif. Perhaps you are more familiar with this word, with this name. This is not the original city of Balkh. Let me write you the word. Turkey was part of the Roman, Eastern Roman Empire at the time. Therefore, he was called Rumi mostly by Western scholars. And but as I said, in non-Western circles, usually he was called Balkhi or more frequently Maulana. Now, you have to be become, or if you are not, you have to be. Familiar with this word Maulana. Maulana means overlord, means overmaster. And this is specifically the word which is being used for him. Now, this word Maula means master, means lord. Maula, of course, in Arabic means for us. Therefore, Maulana altogether means over Lord or over Master. Now, of course, there were many lords or masters around, but Maulana means over Master in the absolute sense of the word. There were actually three words which are being used for Maulana or for Rumi or for Balkhi, whichever you like. Which doesn't have any absolute meaning, but is being used about him, and people understand. First of all is the word Maulana, our Lord. Everybody understand that here, when we use it, Maulana, without naming anybody, means Maulana Jalaluddin, means only. And the word Torba, of course, which means proof. And when Torba is being used, I mean, without further ado, if you like, means the tomb of Rumi. So if somebody tells you that he's going to Torba, without telling you Torba of whom, means he's going to the tomb of Rumi. And when he says that I am reading Maulana, this means he's reading Rumi.
And the third word, which is again being used, is the word Masnavi, which I'm going to tell you a lot, and that is his book. You see, Masnavi, of course, is a very general word, a very general noun. It's a kind of poetry. It's a type of poetry consisting of couplets, of hemistiches, of things. And there are so many Masnavis in Persian, in Arabic, and so on. But when we use the word Masnavi just like that, without adding it to anybody, so you have to understand that this means the Masnavi of Mawlana, Jalaluddin al-Rumi. Now, so again, what for that, you have to know that it means food, of course, to the spoon of Jalaluddin, and the third, which are the most important ones, is his book. Rumi was born in 1207. Roman calendar, 604 according to Islamic calendar, and 1207 Roman calendar in Balkh, as I said, where now it has one of the extinct cities of Afghanistan. He was born into a religious family. His father was a very well-known preacher, and he was at the same time a truly student and a mystic, a Sufi. And Rumi actually came under the influence of his father very greatly. And as we will see later, he read and reread the book of the preachings of his father. His father didn't write any book whatsoever, but his preachings and his sermons actually was collected by his followers in a two-volume book, and that was one of the main capitals for the Rumi. So he was trained in a mystic or Sufi tradition. When he was 12, actually, he migrated with his father and his family, as I said, from Afghanistan to Iran and then to Mecca, and that was because they felt everything that that the invasion of the Mongols was imminent, and most of the people who were well off and who could actually flee from the invasion, they fled from Iran into some other cities which were more peaceful and calm. So they were one of the families who actually preferred not to stay in the city in Balkh, and to migrate to some other places which were far off from the imminent invasion of the Mongols. So they preferred his father actually took them. And as you know, from the east of Iran, they traveled to the west, to Iraq, and from there they went to Mecca and came back to where what now we call it Turkey. They settled there. Of course, first they settled in another city which is now called Aksara, and then they went to where now is called Konya, which is a very, very old city. Muhammad, as we call it, his name actually was Muhammad, that he prefer to say this, is Rumi and Balkhi and all the other titles. His original name was, his passport name, if you like, was Muhammad. And Jalaluddin also, which means the glory of religion, was his title. So Muhammad actually got married in Turkey. And so when his father died, he was 24. And by that time, he was a well-grown-up scholar on his own, standing. And he knew he was a very good, a powerful orator, and a very powerful, steady man. He knew, especially, usually at the time, these kind of talented people were trained into two two languages, they became linguals, and he was at the same time, he knew very well Persian and Arabic. And therefore, when you look at his poetry, you will see that he is at his strongest when he writes poem Persian and Arabic. But when he migrated to Rome, the Roman Empire, so he learned some Turkish. Therefore, bits and pieces of some Turkish, what you will find is but he was not Turkish. I was really astonished when I was invited by St. Luke University in Cuba 2 years ago to a seminar on Rumi, and they were insistent, adamant to prove, and this to the audience, Rumi was a Turk. I mean, that's really ridiculous. I mean, first of all, giants, they do not belong to any religion. I mean, to be sure. I mean, the Iranians are very proud of him, very proud of him, but we do not think that he's a man that must be to Iran and to Iranian people. He's a meta-historical person, belongs to all humanity. And secondly, I mean, it is ridiculous, as I said, to say that he was Turkish, because he said only a few verses in Turkish. He has got 60,000 verses, and all these 60,000 verses, except a few, are in Persian. Now, the judgment is yours. I mean, will you pass your judgment or verdict on him as being a Persian, Iranian, or a Turk? And I may add that he has got some Greek words as well, and some Greek sonnets. You see, because at the time, they were in the neighborhood of the Greeks, so he learned some Greek. And a few years ago, actually, a Greek scholar published published his Greek poetry with some, I'm against translations and explanations. It is fully comprehensible to us. It is not written in the book in Greek letters, but in Arabic or Persian letters. We cannot read it, we cannot understand it, nothing. And but the Greek scholar actually tried to excavate the words, the songs, and to publish it in a comprehensible form. But so far as I know, nobody has claimed that he was Greek. So let us put him in his own proper natural place. And he was an Afghani, and his dialect also was not Iranian. But this might become boring for you, because you do not know very well, and you are not supposed to. The fine and delicate, nuances and differences between the pronunciation of the words in according to the Iranis and the Afghanis and so on. But definitely his accent was Afghani, was not Irani. And when you see the manuscripts of his works, when you see that the writers, the script actually describe, they have demonstrated, and they have ordered how the words are to be pronounced, how to be uttered, which means that it is in the Arabic dialect or accent, not in Persian. But anyway, quite compared to us. And he has got many verses in Arabic, as I said. Again, nobody has claimed that he was an Arab for matter. He was a very powerful orator, as I said. He knew Arabic and Persian very well. And he was a very good and grand jurist at the time, because usually the scholars or the students who were brought up in the classical traditional way of learning and education, they usually deep some fiqh, which means Islamic Sharia, means Islamic jurisprudence. So usually they became a Jewish. And they did some theology, some philosophy, sometimes, not always. And of course, most of them, not all of them, did the Quran and the commentary of Quran and became knowledgeable in the field of the recitatives and Quranic commentary and all this. And when you look at the work of Rumi, you will see that he knew a lot about Quran. Actually, maybe there are 4,000 allusions to Quran in his work, Mathnavi. And this means he was really grounded, if you like, in the world or in the ocean of Quran. He knew it very well. He made so many fine allusions to Quranic verses and teachings and so on, sometimes explicitly, sometimes implicitly. But anyway, in order to understand him, one has to know Quran, no doubt about him, in order to get and to take and to understand his fine allusions, as I said. But of course, he was, very familiar with the Arabic. Especially with one of his great poets, Al-Mutanabbi, and he sometimes borrows ideas, phrases, and concepts from Al-Mutanabbi and some other Arab poets as well. Now, he was, as I said, 24 that his father died, passed away, and by that time he was a renowned person. So he did, the usual regular routine works of a scholar, a religious scholar at the time. He had a mosque for himself, he had a madrasa, means a center of learning. He was a teacher, a very successful teacher, and he was an orator. And he had some affiliations and connections with the ruling body and the ruling class of the city. So, this anecdote actually comes from him, and this belongs to the later stages of his life. He was a very open person. He didn't disclose the Sufi secrets. He did disclose the Sufi secrets, and some secrets that some people have got killed, in the past, because of disclosing those secrets. But he was not even heard by the people or by the theologians or the ulama of his time. And when his son actually asked him about this very curious situation, he said that his situation was a situation of a beloved, but the situation of the previous scholars was a situation of the lovers. And lovers always suffer from pain, from the harassment and things like that, but the lovers are always good, and people look at them very highly. So yes, actually he enjoyed the condition, the place, the situation of the beloved. Everybody actually loves him. Not only the ordinary people, but the ruling class of the time. So he had a very great place there and among them. So he was 24. So he went on. His main teacher, which we should not name him here, it's not necessary, his name was Quran. He was one of the students of his father, and so he was his teacher. So his life was just an ordinary life, as I said, of a scholar. So when he was 38, the earthquake happened, and that was what made him Rumi, as we know him. And before that, he was just a scholar like any other scholar of the time. So, and that earthquake actually happened like this. A gentleman, unknown, appeared in the city of Kurna, where Rumi was living, was teaching his students, had his madrasa and his connections, was leading his life. A gentleman appeared whose name was Shams. Again, Shams was his title. And his name again was Muhammad. Yeah. title was Shamsuddin. It means son of religion. He suddenly found his way into the educated circles of the Konya. His meeting, his first encounter with Rumi was so enigmatic and so mysterious. We do not know much about this encounter. It was so decisive, so crucial, so vital to the whole spiritual life of this encounter remains mysterious. And there are so many mysteries, so many fables, so many authentic stories about it. We know that there was a very great, very, very powerful influence coming from Shams on Rumi, changing him, reshuffling him, if you like, and making a new personality out of him. But what exactly he did, what exactly he said to him, as I said, remains unknown, even to us. Of course, Rumi is poetry, especially in his ghazals, in his sonnets, in his odes, sometimes refers to the teachings, to the mysteries that Shams had confided to him, but he never disclosed that. He never says that very explicitly. But we know that the main, actually, product of Shams and the main heritage of Shams is Rumi. He didn't write any book, and he was no teacher, he was no writer, he was not a scholar in the ordinary sense of the word, but he was a very, very powerful, influential personality that virtually captured and hunted Rumi and changed him to what we know as Rumi, the person. If I want to make a comparison between historical figures, those of you who are familiar with Al-Ghazali, before meeting Shams, Rumi was another Ghazali. And actually he knew Ghazali very, very well, and he read it, studied it. I have written a very lengthy article about the teachings of Ghazali that Rumi has borrowed from him and has actually used them. In Masnavi and in his odes. He was a Ghazali, he was another Ghazali. But after meeting Shams, he became Rumi, as we know. He became a shair, a poet, and a sage, a saint, and the person of Rumi as it is known to us now. So that was when Rumi was 38, roughly 40, the age of maturity. So he really became mature upon the encounter and meeting of Shams. Now Shams stayed with Rumi about 2 years, less than 2 years, interrupted by frequent traveling to Syria and to some other cities. At the first encounter, as I said, Rumi was so attracted to him, virtually left behind everything, his teaching, his followers, his religious sermons, everything he left behind. And he just was sitting with him and left nobody to go to them. Nobody, as I said, knows what they have to say to each other. And what actually Rumi learned from Shams at those times. But it actually was about 6 months. So the followers of Rumi eventually became jealous of Shams, and a kind of enmity developed among them against Shams. And because of this hostility and the hostile atmosphere around him, Shams preferred to leave the city, indeed to escape, and to go to Syria. So upon this separation, Rumi became very upset, and so he sent his son to Syria to die. according to some stories, even he himself went to Syria once or twice. And anyway, eventually they found him, and the Shams went back to Konya. So then he stayed for a shorter period. And eventually he returned to disappear. Now his disappearance, again, is a mystery. We do not know what happened to him. Whether he got killed, which is a strong suggestion by some historians. Got killed by the followers, jealous followers of Rumi, by his enemies. Maybe even some have suggested by the son of Rumi himself, his older son. Or maybe he just disappeared. He went somewhere that we do not know. Some historians have suggested that he came to Iran, where some people think that his tomb now is there. But anyway, it is a mystery and it remains a mystery, and so far nobody has been able to uncover the truth about it. So altogether, roughly less than 2 years Shams stayed with Rumi. This does not mean that he was with Rumi alone. Sometimes he came out, he had some public speeches, public preachings, and these public preachings, usually performed in very, very powerful style, very powerful word. Now we have got it. There were people who wrote it down, who took it down. And now we have got it in a good form, which tells us really the style of Shams and some of the stories that Shams says in his public preachings. You will find in Rumi's work as well, which tells you the degree and extent of the depth that Rumi has got in Shams. And there you will see a man, a very powerful man, who has got no attachment to anything whatsoever. No attachment. And that was exactly the main lesson that he taught Rumi, that he has to detach himself from everything, to liberate himself from everything, especially from his knowledge, especially from his thinking about religion, especially from his followers, especially from the ruling class, from anything. So his main teaching, his main lesson, actually was how to detach oneself from these strong attachments that every one of us has in the world. And Rumi, on top of everybody else, has got it. And so, that is the only thing that we know about Shams. As I said, these pieces that some of his followers have collected, and now we have got it in a good form. And there are interruptions, there are omissions. Sometimes it becomes virtually incomplete. Because when you read it, a sentence sometimes does not end. It is you wouldn't find the last bit of the sentence. Therefore, you have to decide what it could have been and what it could mean. And sometimes there are omissions because they were writing down very quickly and very fast. They couldn't catch every word in order to take it down. So the book is like this. But as I said, the main heritage of Shams is who he is. The book is not very important compared to of a great figure like now he stayed with Rumi about 2 years and then he disappeared. Now, upon the separation, after the leaving of the Shams, for a while, Rumi was so, I don't know how to put the word, so confused, so different, so intoxicated sometimes, that even he did not know what to do, what to say. People around him were not ever really to recognize his past master. He was totally different person, totally different person. He couldn't teach, he couldn't deliver speeches or sermons. He was no man of scholarship any longer. No man of madrasa, of schooling, of school, nothing. He was a totally different person. Now, still his personality has a kind of a strong attachment to the personality of Shams. That the separation of Shams left him empty, I would say. He didn't know. He could not find himself. But by and by, gradually, within a year or so, he swallowed, he digested, swallowed Shams into his personality. He became another Shams. Okay. From this time, Rumi was actually born. So now Rumi is a Ghazali which has swallowed a big piece like Shams. So this is virtually Rumi as we know him. A Ghazali from outside, a Shams from inside. Now, of course, he exteriorized the Shams, which was interior to him for some time. And that is what you will see in his writing and his poetry. All his words actually is a story of separation. And the very first verse of his Masnavi, which I'm going to read you, is the story of separation, according to me. Separation and union, and union at the same time. So the whole word, the whole wisdom of union, and what he has not actually to say is about union and separation. And this separation of Shams was a symbol, was very symbolic to him. Telling you the kind of separation that we suffered from, or perhaps we enjoyed, when we got separated from God, from the supernatural world, from our origin, where it is. Now, Shams left him, and Rumi actually lived for 28 years of the separation. So what he produced are actually the products of these 28 years after the separation. I'm not saying that we do not have anything from him before that period. He was an alim, a good scholar. So some of his sermons now are in existence, and we have got them. So they are very boring. Very in the style of the classical scholar. There are seven sermons, and Majalis is called. Nobody has got it. Really, nobody pay attention to that, except historians, whose job is just to discover interesting or uninteresting. So, therefore, that's good for them, but not for us. Because that belongs to a person which used to be before. We left behind altogether. Now, after the Shams actually began writing poems, but when I use the word writing poems, it was not real writing. He didn't write anything. This does not mean that he was illiterate. He didn't write, he just uttered, he just performed poetry. And there were his followers, his students, who took them down. So he didn't write poems, especially this Masnavi, which is his main didactic work. So he used to actually have meeting with his friends, his followers, in the evenings. So they used to sit together, and Rumi would actually perform the poetry, say his poems, and they took it down. And sometimes they stayed up until dawn. You see, nobody went to bed, nobody slept. And they were just talking, saying, and listening to each other. So that was the way the world was created, it was born. Now, he has got, in these 28 years, that he produced 60,000 verses. He produced two major works. two of them who have them in English, and one of them is not still fully completely translated. Now, the first major work which Rumi is known by it everywhere in the world is Masnavi. And this is in two volumes you have got, and that's about 25,000. In six books, okay. So we have got the first book, we have got the second book, and each book actually contains about 4,000 verses. Why these are books, and why he has actually divided these 25,000 into six books? There is no clear reason behind it. I would say that I am not familiar and reading, studying Rumi now for 35 years. For me, there is no clear reason why there is such a division into six chapters or into six books. I tell you, the works of Rumi, especially his Masnavi, you call it secular or spherical, in the sense that it is not linear. It doesn't begin from a particular point in order to end at another particular end. Every verse of it is the beginning. And I am not exaggerating this. Every verse of this is the beginning of the book and is the end of the book. He really did not pay attention to this traditional way of saying poetry, of writing, rules of producing, works and so on. That was not the case. That is why I said he doesn't begin his work with the name of God. In all classical religious works, you would see that the poet or the writer or the scholar begins with naming God, praising the prophet, and so on and so forth, and then he goes on in order to begin and start his first chapter and the second chapter, and so on and so forth. It is linear. In this particular sense, which I am using the word, it is linear. In the sense that you cannot read the book, from the end to the beginning. But here there is no end and there is no beginning. I tell you this. Those who are familiar with the work, they know that that's why I am saying that it is circular. In a circle, and every point is the beginning and the end. In a sphere, in a spherical shape, you don't have a beginning nor an end. So the book is circle, not in the logical sense of the word, of course, and it is not circular, but it is circular or spherical in this particular sense. Therefore, he did not think about that, and he did not care to begin his work with the words praising God or talking about the prophet, about the creation, things like that. Just actually began with saying that I am complaining from this creation. So look at this lute, look at this leaf, which is telling its story, the story of separation. That is the very first verse of his Masnavi. So he begins with himself. But then he goes on. Sometimes, even he actually plunges into very, very powerful and very deep prayers as if he is sitting in solitude with his God and nothing else, and he is talking to him personally, he is looking at him, he is seeing him, he is touching him, and his words about God, his passions are so strong that you couldn't actually miss it, and you cannot actually keep aloof when he is talking this stuff. But that is not in a cliché form. It is not like that. And he doesn't want to do this for others. He's doing it for him himself, and only himself. Let me tell you, this is one of the main teachings of our Sufis. And of course, this will be more developed in later sessions. You know, of course, the main motto, the main slogan of Islam, of the Prophet of Islam, there is no God but God. There is no God but God. La ilaha illallah. Okay, so of course this is the one of his teaching of the Prophet. Now for Sufis, of course this is correct. There is no God but God. But then of course they have added another thing. Or perhaps they have tried to draw out